Welcome back to Open Line, WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderley. This hour on the show, more than 80% of Americans say the country is headed in the wrong direction. Now, that could be just a tentatively expressed opinion, but my guest this hour, political journalist and organizer David Sirota, says that this isn't just matter-of-factly stated opinion. He says an insurrection is on, a fist-pounding, primal-screaming revolt from a mob wielding protest signs, ballots, computer keyboards, shareholder proxies, and even guns. It's an uprising, he says, originating from Americans on both the political right and the left. We'll find out more. David Sirota, political organizer. He's worked in state and national politics all over America. He's also a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist and a blogger. His new book is The Uprising. It's subtitled an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. David Sirota in Columbus for a book signing. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to call us. Email to openline@wosu.org. So people feel they're getting ripped off, do they? Do they, their pockets are being picked? What's the feeling out there?
Well, I think it goes underneath that. I think people do feel like they're being ripped off, but I think that they believe that the government is in cahoots with those who are ripping them off.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that I think that they believe that the government is not just playing a passive role in the economic crises that we face right now, but is actually playing an active role.
Actively working together with what, an oligarchy?
With big business
with
and
big
corporate
business,
America.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the Abramoff scandal, the corruption scandals of Congress have taught the country that there is a problem with a government that seeks only to serve private interests.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's Abramoff or Halliburton or a lack of an energy policy that helps ExxonMobil make $40 billion a year in profits, I think that people understand that again, it's not just the government not doing its job. It's the government is actually doing a job that is to screw the American worker. And I think that that's what this uprising is all about.
David, do you see this awareness across the political spectrum? I mean, you got people, you went to the Daily Kos convention, the liberal blog site. On the other hand, you hung out with some of the California Minutemen patrolling the border looking for illegal immigrants. Is there anything in common?
I think what the commonality is the realization that the government is not working for the majority of people. The government is bought off. And the question is, which I think you're asking, is whether there is any commonality,
mm-hmm.
whether there can be any commonality. And I don't know if there can be any commonality. What I can say is that there are certainly the same impulses. People feel the same kind of backlash, whether it's on the left or the right. And the backlash is that people believe that there are consensus positions around a lot of major issues in this country and that the government is actually working against that consensus.
Mm-hmm. Let's take the California Minutemen, who you hung out with a little bit, who say they're attempting to stop immigrants from crossing the border, as you point out, because you asked them. It's not just that they think they can really stop illegal immigrants from crossing the Mexican border, but they don't want to embarrass the government by being out there and exposing the fact that they are. Would they say that there's a consensus position they could reach with liberals and centrists about that?
Well, what they would say is that there's a consensus around the issue of border security, that most Americans want us to have secure borders. I think that's actually true. The problem that I have with the Minutemen and where I think that they're wrong is that they would say that border security is the road to economic security.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's not true. I don't even think it's true that border security would solve the situation at the border with undocumented workers. As I told Lou Dobbs when I interviewed him for the book, because I have a whole chapter on him in the book.
I mean, there's an anti-immigrant guy, right?
Well, exactly. What I told him was, I said, Lou, you build a 10-foot wall at the border, and all you're doing is creating a market for 11-foot ladders if you don't actually address the entire problem. And the entire problem is an economic system that helps keep both American workers and Mexican workers under economic pressure.
Mm-hmm.
That if you have a trade policy, for instance, a NAFTA, that helps multinational corporate agribusinesses like Archer Daniels Midland walk into Mexico and wipe out the local farming economy in Mexico, you're going to have a situation where farmers who are put out of work are going to be looking to subsist and potentially looking to come across our border to subsist. So the issue here as it relates to the uprising is that people certainly are angry about government policies that big money interests want. For instance, the immigration issue. Big money interests want the status quo. They want Mexican workers and American workers in a wage-cutting competition. They don't want a solution to this issue. And so the question is whether something positive can be forged out of that general outrage.
How did Lou Dobbs, this is Lou Dobbs of CNN, listeners, I'm sure you know his show, how did he respond to your analysis?
Well, what he said was, that my analysis is, when we had a debate on radio, he said that my analysis was a little bit guilt-ridden. And my analysis was sort of leftist. Now, I don't think it's guilty. I don't feel guilt-ridden or as a leftist to look at the whole economic situation. What I said to Dobbs is I think that he artificially bifurcates the two issues, that Lou Dobbs really represents uprising television, his show does. When he talks about NAFTA, unfair trade, the war on the middle class, corporate power, mm-hmm. he's the only person on television talking about these issues in any consistent way. And I agree with him on a lot of the of his critique of those issues. But he segments those issues from the issue of immigration, which he talks about separately. So trade, corporate power, and the war on the middle class is talked about as an issue of American jobs and American wages. And that's separate from the issue of immigration, which is talked about as a border security issue. Mm-hmm. And never the twain shall meet, even though they clearly do meet in how they interact. But he segments them because it makes people more angry. If you go more for the anger point, if you talk about immigration just as a security issue and economic issues just as an issue of jobs and wages.
He gets more points of anger for his listeners, and he gets, his ratings go up. Is that the idea?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what's happened.
Mm-hmm. It's funny about his issue with immigration because he said at one point that there were huge numbers of cases of leprosy coming into the country because of immigrants, which turned out to be absolutely untrue. In 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl confronted him with this. He denied that he was wrong, but he was wrong.
Oh,
so
yeah.
What's the problem with immigrants?
Well, look, his behavior on that issue, I think, just shows the sort of hubris. of Lou Dobbs. And you better believe I say in the book that the Lou Dobbs show is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week show that the American people only get to see about 1 hour of a night. And by that I mean is that the guy is the same off the air as he is on the air. So I think that that example showed the hubris. I think he does believe that the situation at the border is unacceptable. And the way he thinks it's unacceptable I think is exemplifies what other people see in the border. The border is a symbol for a government that is out of control. The border is an out-of-control place right now. It is. Now, again, I don't agree with Dobbs or the Minutemen on their prescriptions. But it is clear when you look across a border that's unguarded and in many cases has no even structure to delineate where the border is, it's an out-of-control thing. And I think it symbolizes more broadly a feeling that the country right now is out of control and the government is out of control.
Mm-hmm. Political journalist and organizer David Sirota is with us here in Columbus. His new book is The Uprising. It's subtitled An Unauthorized Tour of the Populist Revolt, Scaring Wall Street and Washington. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments and questions to openline@wosu.org. David, you say it's a revolt. I mean, it's reached that level. How do you see that?
Well, because I think that people are actually taking matters into their own hands, that we're beyond the stage of that sort of disengaged stasis that we're used to. And I'll put it in more concrete terms. You know, we typically are in a state where, yeah, we'll watch the TV news and we'll sort of mumble under our breath and be sort of a little annoyed. But I think that more and more people are saying as these economic crises get worse, as people are struggling more and more to pay the bills, healthcare bills or energy bills, whatever bills they are, people are saying, look, I have no choice but to try to do something. I need to do something. And this was actually the quote of one of the Minutemen. I asked really the question of the Minutemen chapter in the book is, what motivates somebody who's not political to leave their house, drive down to the border, and stage what is an elaborate protest in the middle of a desert? And what one of the Minutemen says to me is, he says, look, I was watching TV one day and I just figured I have to get off my butt and go do something. I've got to go do something. And so this book is about what that something is on both the right and left.
You say what motivates somebody to leave their comfortable home, they're apolitical, they drive down into the desert, right, and spend time out there. They got to do something, they say, but is part of the motivation racism?
I certainly think that racism and xenophobia is part of what's going on with the anti-immigrant movement in this country. I certainly think so. But I also think that even more deeply, underneath even that, is that this is a predictable expression, a conservative expression of a society living under fear. That if every time you turn on the television, you're told to be afraid of everything, and specifically to be afraid of terrorism, a lot of folks who were on the border, guarding, quote unquote, guarding the border, were going down there saying that they fear a terrorist infiltration from this out-of-control southern border. Now,
and you felt they were sincere in saying that.
I do. Yeah. I do. I mean, I certainly think I'm not gonna gloss it over. I certainly think there's racism and xenophobia underneath a lot of this. But I also think that racism and xenophobia is exacerbated by a culture that says we have to fear the other. I mean, that is the underlying message of our media culture right now: is fear an infiltration from the other.
Let's talk a little bit about the media. I mean, you say Lou Dobbs is the uprising center in terms of television and the media. What's the rest of the mainstream media doing?
Well, I think the mainstream media is actually part of the establishment that this uprising is railing against. I think that when people turn on the television, they're seeing a reality that they know is not reality. I think as it relates specifically to the political system, they're actually seeing a representation of a political system that doesn't care about them. And whether you see a situation where the media cheered on a war that the public was divided on and now the public is opposed to, or whether you see the financial press celebrating or venerating the gross economic inequalities that are happening in this country. You know, you have books out there called Super Class or Richistan about the wonders of the super rich and how great this is, that there is this inequality. I think, in other words, that the mainstream media has become part of the establishment that this uprising is railing against.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to our phones now with David Sirota, the uprising. Mo is here. Hello, Mo.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I agree with everything that your guest was saying. I just want to make a comment, and I want to see what he thinks. First of all, I watched Lou Dobbs, and a lot of things he says I agree with. But in general, when you listen to the politicians, exactly what your caller is saying, they don't want to solve the problem. You hear good cop, bad cop from both sides, Democrats and Republicans, and people are frustrated. And I think a lot of problems we have about these immigrants is we don't want to look at ourselves and realize that, you know, we have a lot of immigrants working at fast food restaurants. Why? Because the kids don't want to work there anymore. And we see that the price of oil is going up. We don't want to look at ourselves and say, why are we driving 6,000-pound SUVs? So instead of looking at ourselves and see why these guys are coming here and finding jobs, we want to blame immigrants for everything. And I kind of agree, it's getting out of hand. But I also see that the politicians don't want to do anything about it. So I think that public is just frustrated.
Mm-hmm. So David, this is kind of frustration you're hearing, right?
Absolutely. And I think the caller is absolutely right. I think that we know that these debates are rigged because the empirical data tells us that they're rigged. So let's look at immigration. We're told by corporate America and by politicians on one side of the debate that we need either the status quo or immigration, quote-unquote, reform, a lobbyist-written bill for immigration, quote-unquote, reform, because American workers – because corporations need workers. Workers won't take certain jobs. Well, that's – if you look at it on Economics 101, well, why aren't wages rising? Because if there's a labor shortage, if workers are not supposedly don't want jobs, certain jobs, then wages for those jobs would rise to compete for those workers, to compete to fill those jobs.
But they don't.
But they don't. They don't because corporate America and politicians want a cheap, exploitable population to keep those wages down. They want to rig the labor market so that it doesn't work for ordinary workers. So that's one side of the immigration.
You say so that illegal immigrants who come across the border are an important part of our labor market because, number one, they can work for very low – they will work for very low wages. And number two, they can be terrorized into saying, look, you don't want to – like these working conditions, we're going to get rid of you.
Right. There's no legal protections.
There's no legal protections.
They have no union protections. They have no wage protections. Exactly. So the one side of the debate says we need undocumented workers in this country because we have a labor shortage even though wages aren't rising, even though we have the empirical data that shows that there is no labor shortage. In fact, they're using this situation to rig the labor market. And then on the other side, you have people who say that we should build a wall and not deal with the underlying issue of an impoverished country on our southern border. So the caller is right that the political debate around these issues is not really about what's actually going on. And I think that folks who are involved in this uprising understand that the debate itself is broken.
Of course, it's always been easy for any government at any point in American or other history to distract people from the real arguments, you know, to set up a smokescreen and propagandize people. It seems to happen rather easily.
It does. And I think we saw that with the Iraq War, which used 9/11, an unrelated terrorist incident, as the justification to invade another country that had nothing to do with it, based on lies. You see this all the time. But again, I think that the difference at this moment, why I think this is an uprising moment, is because you can't ignore the direct line between government policies and the current crises we live through right now. There is a direct line between, for instance, just one example, between the quote-unquote free trade policies of Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, and the job outsourcing and wage-cutting crisis that we now face. There are direct lines that I think more and more of the public sees and cannot be distracted from.
Mo, thanks for your phone call. But David, you say David Sirota, The Uprising, his new book, you say it's an uprising. You say it's a revolt. That implies that people aren't just talking about this, that they're doing something.
Right.
So what are they doing?
Well, I took a year, and this is what this book is about. I took a year on the road asking that question. And I think you see it with the Minutemen. We know what they're doing. We know what I went and visited Seattle to look at union organizers trying to organize and unionize Microsoft workers, high-tech workers. I looked at third-party politics in New York State and how a third party there, the Working Families Party, has become the most powerful third party in America. I looked at shareholder activists. I snuck into the ExxonMobil shareholder meeting in 2007 with a group of shareholder activists to see how they're using shareholder resolutions to organize this uprising. I spent time with the anti-war uprising, looking at what I concluded is the failure of that uprising to create change, although I think it certainly is an uprising. So there's a huge number of things that are going on. The question in the book is, and I don't answer it concretely because I don't think there is a concrete answer yet, is which of these uprisings is going to be successful and which direction will this uprising ultimately drive the country in? It can drive it into a progressive direction. I think a lot of people feel like this is a democratic moment, a progressive moment. But as I say in the book, I think there's a possibility this could go in a conservative direction. It depends on who organizes this uprising most successfully.
Okay. By the way, you mentioned in Seattle organizing workers at Microsoft are attempting to do that. And I guess the stimulus for that is what, about a third of workers at Microsoft are what they call permanent temporaries? In other words, they're on full time and it's pretty – they could be there for years but they don't get benefits?
This is the new kind of economy that we're moving into, which is very frightening for everybody. In Microsoft, they call them permatemps. They are permanently employed there, but they are employed under temporary conditions. That is, no benefits, on a sort of freelance basis. And in fact, they're employed through temp agencies. There's a temp middleman. And this is happening in all parts of the economy, the freelanceization of labor, which basically gives employers the right or the legal structure to avoid giving workers benefits. This is happening throughout the economy, and I think as it happens, it is sowing this kind of intense anger that is fueling this uprising.
So at Microsoft, for example, when we say they don't get benefits, they don't get health insurance?
They get health insurance through the temp agency, but if they have a problem with their health insurance, or they have a problem with their wages, or they have a problem with their benefits, they have to go through the temp agency. In other words, Microsoft can say, well, you have to take it over to the temp agency, and the temp agency, well, you're actually employed by Microsoft. They are literally in an employment purgatory where there's no accountability whatsoever.
And they might be working for Microsoft for years.
For years and years.
Yeah. And some of the traditional unions were not much help?
Well, when this designation came into being in Washington State and there was a ruling about whether you had to pay perma-temps overtime, some of the unions, the traditional unions, were in on the state regulation that allowed this to happen because they cut a deal making sure that their unionized members were given those overtime protections. And so what ended up happening is that a separate organization formed spontaneously, really, in Washington State to try to organize tech workers, in part because those workers didn't even feel like the traditional labor movement was interested in helping them.
Any success in organizing?
Well, they've organized a 1,000-person workplace of AT&T. There has not been success in organizing Microsoft or Amazon. And what I look at in the book is what are the prospects for success? And the most interesting part, I think, is that, you know, we're led to believe that tech companies, because their CEOs wear button-down shirts and khakis and smile a lot, are very nice guys, Bill Gates, et cetera, and that they're benevolent kind of CEOs. But as I found, they're just as brutal and just as cutthroat as the CEOs of Walmart when it comes to unions and labor issues.
Back to our phones. Doug is here. Hello, Doug.
Yes, well, I think David Sirota is the real deal. He's about the only op-ed writer in America that really tells the truth on economic issues and other issues. But and I would urge people to, you know, call the Columbus Dispatch editorial page editor and request for him to be in the Dispatch. You know, the all the so-called liberal op-ed writers in the Dispatch are, you know, Tom Friedman, Fareed Zakaria. They're always for all the free trade deals and they're considered the liberal ones. But I would also like to ask him, what would he think of Sherrod Brown as Vice President Obama's running mate?
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the plug, too. I appreciate it. I think you make a good distinction about the definition of liberal and conservative in the media. We define right now in the media, I think, you can be defined as a liberal if you're pro-choice and for shipping everybody's job overseas. I don't think that's really much of a liberal or a progressive. I think that's a royalist. Although I am pro-choice. I just think that allowing economic royalists to represent progressive politics is a really one of the major distortions in our media political debate today. As it relates to Sherrod Brown, look, I have a half of a chapter in my book is about Sherrod Brown. I spent time in the book asking the question, can somebody like Sherrod Brown, who is elected on an uprising platform, on a populist economic platform, can somebody like that represent the uprising in an institution like the U.S. Senate? And I look at how the institution of the Senate is actually specifically structured to stop uprisings. The name of the chapter is called The Permanent Barrier. That is Alexander Hamilton's phrase that he used to justify the original creation of the U.S. Senate. He said we need a permanent barrier to the popular will. And so I asked that question, and it was a very interesting response from Sherrod. You know, he says that people have to realize that change is the Senate is the last place change comes to, not the first, and that he says that he sees his office. And this is, having worked on the Hill, I can say this is unlike most legislators there. He sees his office as both as a legislative office and as an office to stir up outside pressure on the very institution that he's in, which I think is a very, very important outlook. And so as it relates to the presidential race, I think having somebody like Sherrod Brown on the ticket who has that understanding, who has that outlook, who does really represent the uprising, would be fantastic for Barack Obama. And not just because he's from Ohio, which is an important state, but because Obama has, I think, wavered between trying to represent the uprising and trying to appease the establishment. I think Obama needs to pick somebody that makes very clear, crystal clear, that he is behind this populist economic uprising. And I can think of no better person than Sherrod Brown.
Doug, thanks for your call. We got a break here. We're with David Sirota, political organizer, political journalist, whose new book, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. Back after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day, a young man in East Los Angeles is afraid to let his sisters walk outside.
I'll pick them up right after school. If they want to go to the movies, I'll drop them off. Not that long ago, they shot a little girl.
His neighborhood is ruled by gangs, and neighbors can do little to stop them.
They have to go back to that neighborhood, so if they testify, they're going to get threatened and intimidated.
One family struggles to stay safe.
Police kill one gunman in a shootout.
Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in just about 30 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 73 degrees at 11:32. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Here are today's big stories put in perspective on All Things Considered. Hosts Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Melissa Block, and WOSU's Christina Morgan present a mix of news, interviews, commentaries, reviews, and offbeat features. Listen to All Things Considered, weekdays starting at 4, now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News and Classical Music. In the weather forecast for today, sunny skies. Looks like it'll be a nice day and a high around 82. Mostly clear tonight and a low of 58. For Wednesday, partly sunny, there is a slight chance of some late day showers and a high of 85. For Thursday, mostly cloudy, a chance of afternoon rain and a high of 85. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. My guest this hour, political journalist and organizer David Sirota, says that there's an insurrection going on out there across America, coming from both the right and the left. He says it's a fist-pounding, primal, screaming revolt from a mob wielding protest signs, ballots, computer keyboards, shareholder proxies, and even guns, an uprising, he said. And we'll find out more. Again, David Sirota, political organizer. He's worked in state and national politics all over America. He's a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist and a blogger, and his new book is The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. David, you're in Columbus. You're going to be doing a book signing.
Right.
Right after the show.
Right after the show at 12:30 p.m. I'll be at Progress Ohio's headquarters at 251 South 3rd Street in Columbus.
Okay, 251 South 3rd Street in Columbus. By the way, 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org. We were talking during the break, David, and you thought what was very interesting about Sherrod Brown is he ran openly as a progressive here in Ohio, which is not a totally progressive state.
Right. I mean, this is the as I say, at least in national elections, has been the beating heart of establishment Republicanism for a long time as it relates to presidential elections, that Republican presidents, Republican nominees cannot win the United States without winning Ohio. And what was fascinating about the 2006 election is that in a state like that, that you had Sherrod Brown running as an unabashed progressive, not doing the typical Clintonian triangulation of not saying he's a Democrat, not saying he's a progressive, triangulating against core progressive positions. You did not see that. You saw him embrace the progressive agenda in about as full-throated a way as you've seen from any candidate. And what's fascinating about that is that he very easily could have done the other done the other kind of thing. I mean, right next door in Indiana, you've got Evan Bayh, a guy who basically tries to pretend he's not a Democrat, takes all sorts of conservative positions, juxtaposes himself often against the progressive base in a conservative state. So I thought what Scherer did, and I talk about this in the book, was he really showed in about as powerful a way as possible that you can be a progressive populist, you can say you're a progressive populist, and you can win the most politically important state in the country. And that is a huge message to the political establishment that says that you have to basically embrace corporate conservatism in order to win in states like this. He has rejected that.
What are the core progressive positions?
Well, I think it's right now at this moment, I think it's getting out of the war in Iraq. I think it's restoring some semblance of fairness to the economy. By that, there's a whole subset of issues, you know, re-regulating Wall Street, cracking down on the oil companies, cracking down on the healthcare companies, expanding healthcare access to universal healthcare, shoring up the social safety net. Basically, overarching all of this is a new national security policy that redefines strength as a multifaceted definition, not just one that means politicians sitting in air-conditioned offices calling in airstrikes on dark-skinned foreigners halfway across the globe. And I think it also means of economic fairness and all of the things that goes under that mantra.
We talked about the uprising, and I asked you, gee, what are people doing? And one of the groups you cited is something, a political party in New York State called the Working Families Party. What are they up to?
Well, they are using something called fusion voting to leverage real third-party power for the progressive uprising. I'm glad you asked this question here in Ohio. Fusion voting allows small parties to cross-endorse major party candidates for office on the ballot. So if I'm running for the U.S. Senate in a fusion state, I can run as the nominee of the Democratic Party and the Working Families Party, assuming I get their nomination. Mm-hmm. And if there's two voters, one votes for me on the Democratic Party line, one votes for me on the Working Families Party line, I get two votes.
You get both lines on the ballot? You're marked on both?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. My name appears on both lines. And if I get two votes, one on the Democratic line and one on the Working Families line, I get two votes. The votes are fused together. So what this has done is the Working Families Party has defined itself on a narrow set of economic issues, for instance, raising the minimum wage. And what happens is that let's say I get elected to the legislature and I got 15% of my vote on the Working Families line. When a bill that comes down to raise the minimum wage comes down the pike and I look at the bill and I'm deciding whether to vote for it or not, if I vote against it, I will know that I'll probably sacrifice 15% of my vote in the next election because the Working Families Party will withdraw its endorsement of me in the next election. So this is leverage real power. And the reason I said it's important for Ohio is because Ohio, I believe, had a ballot initiative or certainly will have a ballot initiative in some point in the future is my guess, to re-legalize fusion voting. Fusion voting used to be legal in every state in the country. It was allowing at the turn of the 20th century, in the 1900s, it was allowing the populist party and the Democratic Party to find common cause around economic populist candidates. The populist party represented rural farmers. The Democratic Party was perceived as representing immigrants in the cities, not exactly culturally similar constituencies, but a shared economic agenda. Mm-hmm. It was outlawed by Mark Hanna. Mark Hanna, the chief political strategist to William McKinley, who I believe is from Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Mark Hanna was the Karl Rove of his generation. Karl Rove actually says that Mark Hanna was his hero. Mark Hanna orchestrated the campaign to illegalize fusion voting. And the quest to re-legalize it is, I think, a quest to help make sure that uprisings have a place on the ballot.
I think the Conservative Party for many years in New York State did the same thing, right?
Absolutely.
If you got the Conservative Party in dormant, you got their votes, they'd fuse.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And this I think, can be a real kind of reform that allows third parties to play a powerful role, not just at the presidential level, where we see sort of these protest candidacies, where we can actually have third-party politics in this country that leverages real power at the local and state level.
Mm-hmm. 614-292-8513, David Sirota, The Uprising. Bill is on the line. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how are you gentlemen today?
Well, good.
Very good.
I just wanted to point out to you that under Bill Clinton, and I happen to be a Democrat, they got rid of Glass-Steagall. And Glass-Steagall was Depression-era legislation that separated the brokerage firms from the banks, okay, from the insurance companies, because they knew that the three of those guys in bed together was a bad news because they all fed off each other. And with between that and basically the elimination of the Sherman-Addy Trust Act in all but, you know, name, because every consolidation is seen as a plus. You know, you have to have scale, you know, in order to be competitive. Between those two things, you know, they've almost eliminated, they've consolidated the bulk of the money. And I was reading in the Wall Street Journal just the other day that now, and I've seen it from two different angles, that they want to allow the brokerage firms to go to the federal government for money in the same way that the banks do. And I just think that is lethal because, again, that is pretty much what brought the Great Depression on, was the leverage, the borrowing from the government as the last resort. And when the fall came, which is coming now as far as I'm concerned, it was just, well, we all know what it was.
Well, Bill, hang on the line. David, your thoughts.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that people are realizing that when you deregulate Wall Street, you deregulate the financial system under the guise of conservative populism, because that's what – that was the veneer that this was done under, that we have to unleash the market, that liberals are trying to hurt the market, and that the populist position is to unleash the market. People have seen we're living through the results of fake populism, of that kind of fake conservative populism. And I want to really stress the idea that you're right, that this uprising really is transpartisan, that I think people know that these policies have been embraced by both parties. Look, Bill Clinton was the guy who promised not to sign NAFTA until Mexico raised its labor and wage standards, and then 16 months later, as president, rammed it through Congress. Bill Clinton was the guy who signed telecom deregulation. Bill Clinton was the guy who signed welfare, quote-unquote, reform. Bill Clinton was the guy who helped eliminate Glass-Steagall, as you said. So, and I'm not absolving the Republicans, by the way. But the point is that I think people realize that this transcends any one party, that the us versus them is not Democrat versus Republican, that the us versus them is the have-nots versus the haves.
David, you talked about a fake conservative populism. Is there a genuine conservative populism?
Yes. I mean, I certainly think that some of the themes that Ron Paul has echoed is genuine conservative populism. I don't agree with a lot of it, but I think that issues of civil liberties. When you hear conservatives talk about, like Ron Paul, that the government is impinging on our civil liberties and that's unacceptable, I think that's genuine conservative populism. I even think that when you see conservatives talk about rank and file conservatives talk about issues of taxes, and I'm not distinguishing from conservative establishment elites from rank and file conservatives. I think when you have people feeling anger at taxes, rank and file people, I think that's genuine conservative populism, because I think that the tax burden right now is too much on ordinary people. Where fake populism comes in is when fake populists take that anger at that iniquity and say, well, the way to fix that iniquity is to cut taxes for billionaires. That's fake populism.
We should get a definition of populism.
Right. Well, populism, I think it's a loosely defined term that I think is the politics of backlash, the politics of blame, and is basically, in the context of that, majority politics. So now that's a lot of concepts. But the idea that people are angry and people want to blame something. And I'm not making a value judgment. There's a lot of things out there that deserve blame. The Enron executives deserve blame for Enron. The government deserves blame for making our tax system unfair. And it's majority. It's majority politics. That is, that situations where we have majority positions in the country that are not being represented by the establishment. So, you know, most Americans want out of the war in Iraq. Most Americans want a universal health care program. Most Americans want us to crack down on the oil companies. Those are populist positions, especially in light of the fact that the government is doing exactly the opposite.
Thank you, Bill, for your call. David Sirota, political organizer and journalist here in Columbus with us this hour. His new book, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. 614-292-8513. Email openline at WOSU.org. David, once again, you're going to be signing your books shortly after the show.
Right. 251 South 3rd Street in Columbus. Be at the Progress Ohio headquarters.
And that is a liberal think tank here in Columbus.
Correct.
Progress Ohio. Sean is on the line. Hi, Sean. Hello, Sean. Are you there? All right. Sean is not there. Let us try Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you, Mr. Sirota. I've noticed since, maybe around 2004 that there's been, in the evangelical Christian community, there's been more interest, and if you listen to people like Jim Wallace and Rick Warren and maybe Richard Cizik, in what I would consider to be also populist issues. And I wondered, have you explored any of that in your book, and do you have an opinion on it?
Yeah, I do explore some of it in my book, and I do have an opinion on it. I think that you're right, that the religious, I guess, traditionally called conservative constituencies in this country are fracturing. That people who organize around their religious beliefs are now figuring out that perhaps that doesn't mean that they should or have to be conservative, quote unquote, conservative on all issues, especially economic issues. And we have proof of this in the candidacy of Mike Huckabee, the Republican presidential candidate. He ran. And he's a conservative Republican, socially conservative on social issues, on religious issues. But he also was running around talking about CEOs being paid too much, income inequality, essentially the class war. He was basically taking a very economically populist position on the issues relating to this economic class war that we face. Now, I didn't agree with his prescriptions. You know, I didn't agree with what he was saying we needed to do to fix things. But he was railing on wealth concentration, corporate power, et cetera, et cetera. And okay, so he didn't win the Republican nomination, but he won a number of primaries in very, very conservative states, which suggest that in fact, that the religious conservative community is perhaps, and I think this is a great thing, is perhaps rethinking its positions in lockstep with the corporate elite in the Republican Party. It is sort of an unholy alliance, right? You've got Wall Street bankers in the same party as working class cultural conservatives, even though the Wall Street bankers' economic interests are diametrically opposite of many of those working class cultural conservatives. And I think that split can be exploited if Democrats and progressives really fully embrace a progressive populist economic agenda.
Mike, a follow-up question here?
Well, no, you gave a really good answer to it, and I totally agree with it.
Okay, got to move on then. Thanks. What do you see in this populist revolt? People very upset across the political spectrum, David, as you say. What's the response in Washington? What's from the establishment there? What's the response in Wall Street? Is it making a dent? Are they trying to figure out how to co-opt this response? What are they doing?
Co-option is the right word, at least rhetorically. You saw in the Democratic primary, John Edwards is about the purest populist that has run for president in the last generation at least. And you saw most of the other candidates in that primary co-opt his message. I think that's a good thing. On Wall Street and in financial circles, when I was in at the ExxonMobil meeting, you saw Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, all of a sudden starting to say he understands that we need to think about global warming. I mean, that's not a huge step, but it's a step. The issue will be, especially as it relates to this presidential election, will be whether the rhetoric is forced into action. We hear, especially from Barack Obama, that he is a movement, that he is a social movement. You see that in his email dispatches, his press releases that join the movement. But the issue is that no candidate, politician, or individual election is a social movement unto itself. That if we want real change, if this uprising is going to make real change, it has to force the rhetoric to become real action. That voting for Barack Obama, for instance, is not creating change. It is creating the opportunity or the possibility of progressive populist change. But that's only an opportunity. That change will only come if this uprising becomes a movement that puts constant pressure on both parties to actually live up to their promises.
What about John McCain? Does he have populist sentiment?
I certainly think he's another potential vehicle. As a progressive and somebody who's worked in politics, I think Barack Obama offers more potential. But I think any politician can be a vehicle if the right kind of pressure is put on them. And I just remind people of Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, when we had that tiff in the presidential race where Hillary Clinton said Martin Luther King needed a president to pass civil rights laws, I thought what she misunderstood there was that's not how power works in this country. Lyndon Johnson opposed civil rights laws for most of his career. But what happened was a movement changed the political tectonics underneath him, changed the topography of American politics underneath him to make it more politically opportune for him to embrace civil rights laws than to reject them. And so with McCain, as with any politician of any party, if you change the ground underneath a politician and make it better for them, easier for them, more opportunistic for them to embrace change and to embrace the status quo, then you'll get change.
At the same time, of course, Vice President Dick Cheney recently and famously said that public opinion on the war doesn't matter, and you quote an unnamed Democratic lawmaker who said essentially the same thing.
That's right. And I think what Cheney is saying is an incredible statement, basically from somebody who's in a lame duck situation. So I guess to him, public opinion doesn't matter. And I guess in certain lame duck situations, politicians can say that. But generally, politicians can't really say that because they are running for re-election. And I think that what that Democrat is saying that you reference is that the political topography hasn't changed enough, that the Democratic Party, in writing checks, cutting checks for the most unpopular war in history to the most unpopular president in history, what the Democratic Party is saying by that is we're still somehow more afraid of changing direction than of embracing the status quo. And that means we've got, at least as it relates to the anti-war uprising, we've got our work cut out for us.
So a change has to come from the grassroots. It's not going to happen in the Senate, as Sherrod Brown suggested.
Well, it will be reflected in the Senate when there's enough change. But it's not going to start in the U.S. Senate. It's not. I think you've seen this time and time and time again. On the war, the debate on the war itself. Remember, before 2006, we were having a debate about how to better manage the war and whether to intensify it or not. After 2006, the debate has at least become whether to end it or not. At least we're there. And that happened because, I think, in part, because you saw one grassroots uprising in Connecticut power a insurgent primary challenge through Ned Lamont to U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and he defeated Lieberman in the Democratic primary. Now, Lieberman ultimately went on to win the general election, but that defeat got so much media attention. It scared the rest of the entire political establishment to change its entire rhetoric, at least on the war. Now, you're right. It's a rhetorical change. It hasn't been a substantive change yet, but movements take steps, and that was the kind of step that gets us closer to ending the war.
Wall Street, how are they responding to these kinds of
Well, look, I think Wall Street's where you really see the fear, the unbridled fear. I mean, there was a story in I think it was Fortune magazine about Wall Street fearing the rising membership of unions. You see the Chamber of Commerce telling reporters that it's afraid that there's going to be an end to NAFTA-style trade policies and a beginning of a fair trade era. The way Wall Street is responding is, I think, really unbridled fear. They don't really know what to do. I think they're unfortunately still being kept fat and happy through the bailouts like we've saw with Bear Stearns. And look, I think that money will always play a major role in our politics as long as we have campaign finance laws that allow legalized bribery, as long as we don't have a public financing system of elections. But I think that Wall Street is going to intensify its efforts to buy politics. And what we're going to hear, and people need to get used to this, what we're going to start hearing is that major changes are not acceptable or not realistic or dangerous. We're going to start hearing that in our media from lobbyists, from politicians, from pundits. All of those establishment voices are going to be saying that. And my message to everybody listening here is that when you hear that, when you hear, oh, we can't do universal health care, it's too hard. Oh, we can't reform our trade laws, the people who want to reform our trade laws are Luddites or protectionists. You should be thinking, we are winning. We are winning because as those fear-based comments telling us that things are not acceptable or not going to happen bubble up, it means that we are making progress. Remember, every major accomplishment we've had in this country was preceded by people saying that. I'm sure there are people back in the civil rights years saying, oh, we can't repeal Jim Crow laws. You know, I'm sure there are people saying, oh, we can't do Social Security. That means we're getting closer.
So the major media pundits, I mean the people who are so self-congratulatory about themselves and about how well they cover the news, you feel they're going to defend the status quo too. I mean, you're going to have a Chris Matthews, you're going to have a Keith Olbermann. He says he's on the left, but nonetheless, you're going to have Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I differentiate Olbermann from those, but from the other two. But yes, I think as you read even quote unquote objective news stories, you see the establishment bias right in there. Folks in Ohio, a state that has been decimated by these unfair trade deals, when you read a typical business press story about our trade laws, the people who want fair trade are billed as Luddites, and the people who want the current status quo of this quote-unquote free trade are billed as enlightened. In fact, even the very term free trade is rigged unto itself. A free trade deal would be one page long. Free trade deals are thousands of pages long. The other thousands of pages are protectionist policies, but they're protectionists for corporate profits, so we don't talk about them. And so I think that you see the establishment bias in the media, and you're going to see that bias become more and more pronounced as this uprising becomes, hopefully, a social movement.
Interesting. Paul Krugman, the liberal economist for the New York Times, in a recent column said, look, I'm for free trade, but I've got to admit it's depriving people of jobs here in America, and we're not giving them the job training, and they are displaced, and we've got to do something. Because in that sense, he said he didn't renege on his support of free trade, but he said it's not working.
Look, there is no such thing as free trade. You have NAFTA, which is one set of trade laws, rules about how you trade, and you have other models of rules about trade. The NAFTA model, which we live under, which is called free trade, a misnomer. The NAFTA model says that we should put Americans into a wage-cutting environment, destroying competition with foreign slave labor. Yet we should, for instance, protect pharmaceutical patents. We should have protectionist policies in the trade deals that allow pharmaceutical companies to have patent protection to charge Brazilians higher prices for AIDS drugs than the market would command. You've got protectionist policies in there that allow foreign corporations to sue state governments if they pass public interest laws. So it's a whole misnomer, and I think that the trade debate is changing rapidly.
David Sirota, The Uprising, his new book. David, you can find your blog at
www.credoaction.com/Sirota, CREDOACTION.com/SIROTA.
David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Donald R. Glancy Endowed Fund, a legacy of commitment to great programming on WOSU Public Media.